We're starting today in just in a few moments. And we'll be taking up yesterday's Parsha Kedoshim. Okay, the verse we'll be taking up is it's in Kedoshim, right in the beginning, the first couple of verses in the parsha. It's Leviticus 19, verse 4 is what we'll take up, but we'll be discussing a little bit more than that. And again, we'll start just in about 1 minute. And if you're joining us online, just type in audio OK at the bottom of your screen. It'll confirm for us that you're picking up the audio feed properly. Good morning, Doug, Cal.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Good. How have the two of you been? Good morning.
John, you still there? Still here. Okay.
All right. Okay, I wanted to do this morning, I was thinking of doing something morality, but we had a very interesting discussion yesterday on the Parsha and Kedoshim. So if you take a look right in the beginning, excuse me, it's 19:4. Leviticus 19:4. We'll take a look. You can look, you know, read the first couple of verses too, because it's right in the beginning of the parsha. I can't tell unless you give me some clue as to what that question is.
Well, it says, my translation says, do not turn to the idols, and molten God shall you not make for yourselves. So what's the difference between the two? Why does it mention both?
Well, there's more of a clue if you look at the verse carefully. Also the warning that's attached to each one. What's the respective warning? See, but it says don't turn to the Elilim. Is the first one, right? The second one says don't make. Do not create. But it's hard. But you can't pick up on that right away, because I guess the way the human mind works is that you first... When you first notice an initial distinction between, you know, the idols or the molten gods, so then the mind focuses on that specific point. So then, since it has a certain singular point to focus, you won't catch the other thing until that's been digested, and then you go back and review again. So that just seems to be the way the mind works, is that when it notices a distinction, it has to focus on one. The mind works on looking at a singular point. But then if you look at it again, you will see that, you know, it says, do not turn to the Elilim, and to the molten gods, don't make for yourself. But then there's even more that we can extract from this verse. We can ask, well, you tell me, what else do you think might be an issue? Okay.
Because, first of all, it seems like you would make something and then you would turn to it, not you would turn to it and then make it.
Well, I'll take issue with that. If you see things that you want to maybe worship in the world, you know, like the sun and the moon or something like that, then you might want to make something to duplicate that.
Yeah, but the first wouldn't be it. Just turning to the sun and the moon wouldn't be an idol.
No. If you worship those things, some of those are idolatry.
Yeah, both Ibn Ezra and Rashi explain that Elilim is referring to something which really has no importance whatsoever. Look, he says, Ibn Ezra says, they are figurines that people create. It's interesting, the word in Hebrew, he calls them psilim. So psil could mean a strand. Actually, no, psil, I think that's a different letter. Here, it's the same letters as something which is null. It's interesting that the word pesel, which means idolatry or an idol, also is from the word tussle, which means null and void, like nothing to it. So it's interesting that the Hebrew language has that corollary to its actual meaning. And that's what Ibn Ezra says. And Rashi says, Ibn Ezra says at the end, they're called this because they are false items, like a false doctor. Or like I guess he's quoting something from the prophets, where certain people were considered, they were all false doctors. And he says the reason for the name is because there is nothing to them. But Tom, and the reason why it has a name, she'einenu yesh, there is nothing to them at all. Interesting, what is he pointing at? And Rashi says, don't turn to these elilim to worship them. And then he says the word elilim is a language, kolohu chashev, as if it is not of any importance. Okay. But it's interesting, but the elilim is saying that you shouldn't turn to them, you shouldn't incline. And what does it mean, incline? Ibn Ezra says, even in your heart to gaze. Even in your heart to gaze upon it. Meaning, you entertain it in your mind as being anything whatsoever. And by the molten gods, what can you ask about that statement? It says, and gods that are molten, do not make for yourselves, I am God, your God.
Well, I could ask, why does it specifically say molten?
Exactly.
You could make something out of, you know, canvas and stuffing.
Or accepting the sun as a god, or the Asherah tree. They had these trees that were planted for idolatrous assumptions.
Right.
Right?
Lots of possibilities. So what's specific about melting down something?
Right. Well, molten, I guess, where they liquefy a metal and they create a form. Right? And Unculus translates molten as metal, which is consistent. Because metal, I guess, is made through, you know, a melting process. So, but I think the question to start off with is, what is this concept of turning in the mind, and also the idea of molten gods as being prohibited here, as opposed to any other type of idolatry? That's a very interesting type of idea. And actually, the question came up from my friend Heshi, who he mentioned this past Friday night. That you see that's used also when God accuses the Jews, when Moses is on top of the mountain, and God says to Moses, leave me alone, go down, because they've created a molten god. Right, that's in the Parsha Kisisa. Let's see what the Mefarshim, what the commentators say on that.
So he was asking, why is it specifically about molten?
Yeah, he was just curious because he was looking at this week's Parsha, and he immediately associated. He's a sharp guy. Let's see what says that. Okay. This is in Exodus. It's Exodus 32:8. And God says to Moses, go down, because your people have been destructive, that you took out of Mitzrayim. They have quickly turned aside from the path which I have commanded them, and they made for themselves a molten calf, and they bowed down to it. And they sacrificed to it. And they said, these are the gods of Israel that took us out of, that took you out of Egypt. Okay. And what does Unculus say over here? Well, yeah. A metal calf is what he says. There's nothing on Rashi. Ibn Ezra also doesn't say anything about that verse. Not too much here on that verse. I guess it's pretty clear. Yeah, I don't see anybody really commenting on this. So we'll have to go what we have in terms of we have in Kedoshim, in Leviticus. But let's think for a second. What is the difference between idolatry? Let's say you bow down to the sun, or the moon, or the stars, or an animal, or a tree, or even a large stone that you find. Contrast that to a molten. What's the difference?
The difference seems to be that those things are already there, and a molten is something that man creates.
Ah, very good.
So, wouldn't that mean that then it would be possible for man to take on sort of the identity of this power of I have the ability to create and associate with being like God?
Well, I don't think he's doing idolatry in order to have a role as a master. He is creating it because he wants to be subservient to this thing, and he attributes all the power to the object. So I wouldn't agree with that. I would say that the creativity, that there is, it is true what you're saying, though. That your point is accurate, and I think it's right on target, that it is where man creates it. But I don't think the creation over here means to correlate to mastery. Creation could also signify something else. And I think it has to do with the first part of the verse where it says, don't turn even in your heart. Ibn Ezra is pointing out that this prohibition. And it's interesting that, you know, Kedoshim, Rabbi Chaik gave a very nice class this years ago. I think the consensus, though, on this whole parsha, this section, is that if the Torah has all the commands, so just follow the commands, right? You have 613 commands, so follow them. And what do you add by saying also be kadosh? What more can you do if you're keeping all the commands? So the rabbis say, I'm trying to see where it is. Let's see. I believe that they said that it means that you should sanctify yourself even with that which is permitted to you. Meaning food and intercourse are permitted. But a person can be what they call manuvel b'rishus haTorah. A person can be disgusting even within the confines of the law. He can eat all day, he can drink all day, have intercourse all day, and he's not breaking any law. But he is going against the real perfection. I believe Rabbi Chait said this a number of times, that the Torah cannot legislate perfection. It can give you actions, but in terms of realizing the perfection and applying it to yourself and understanding the application. So that is something a person has to be able to come to on his own. I mean, there's room for a person to be involved in all these pleasures. He can become, you know, filthy rich and not have to work and have all the time on his hands to do what he wants. And he's not going to be in violation. But he's definitely going against the whole philosophy of the Torah. Because he's not spending his days, you know, in study. He's lounging and eating and you know, just hedonistic, hedonism is all he's involved in. So this parsha is telling a person to focus on the real underlying idea of the Torah. So with that in mind, what might we say about what we're discussing here?
Turn to idols is like the overall prohibition.
Well, go with...
Still struggling with the issue of why molten.
Well, Cal made a good first step, and that was that everything else already exists.
So what would be the difference? I melt down some metal and pour it into a mold versus I take a piece of cloth and I stuff it with grass and I make a little figure out of it and sew it up.
That, I think, would be similar. But I think that those two would be set apart from if you bow down to the sun or the moon or trees or animals or even a rock, a stone that you find. There's a difference, I believe.
Okay. Go ahead.
I believe that the difference is that at least, I'm just trying to remember something that Howie said yesterday. He made a point that certain people believe that there's a piece of God in everybody. This is actually in the Hasidim they have in his book called the Tanya. I think it's pretty much the Lubavitch set. And in it, they have a heretical statement that there's a literal piece of God in everybody. So we know that, you know, from just reason alone, that something which is not physical cannot be divided. So there can't be parts to an idea that also can't be parts to God. And to suggest that goes against one of the 13 principles, and that God is not similar to the physical world in any way whatsoever. And since the physical world is subject to division by its very physical nature, so God cannot have parts. Now, Howie was quoting Rabbi Chaya, said that that's worse than the idolaters, because the idolaters only made a mistake in how to worship God. So they didn't say, like Maimonides says in the very beginning of his Laws of Idolatry, he says, the idolaters didn't say there's no God. They said, of course there's a God, but the way we serve him is by worshiping the stars in the heaven, because the stars minister to God. They made that was their first error, was that they said that since these stars are in heaven and they minister to God, so therefore we should worship the stars. So they attributed proximity to the stars, which is, of course, you know, false. God does not take up any space. He's not in any place. The rabbis say that the world is not the place of God. God is the place of the world. So what does it mean, God is the place of the world? I mean, God's very existence is the substratum, the reason why the world can exist. So a way of saying that God is essential for the world to exist is like saying God is the place of the world. Just like if you didn't have a place, you couldn't have an object, because objects need to take up space. So also, if you didn't have God, if that were possible to say, which is impossible, but if a person would even let, you know, like the Rambam says, if he'd even entertain that on his heart, so then nothing else could exist. So these idolaters the original idolaters made a mistake. That they thought that there was in the heavens is where God resided. So they said, well, since God's in the heavens, so therefore we should worship those things that minister to God, the stars. So that is only a mistake in terms of how to worship God. But those people who say there's a piece of God in everybody, so that's a mistake about God himself. So that's worse.
Rabbi, can I ask a question about that?
Yeah.
You think of sort of the life force that is breathed into us at birth that comes from God. It's not a piece, but it's a well, it's what gives us life.
Yeah, but that is a created thing.
What do you mean?
That what you're referring to is a life force.
God, but it certainly comes from God.
No. I don't think saying come from God is good, because it has a connotation that it's of God. It is of God, but that's not true. It's, for example, I mean, you could say the earth comes from God if you mean to say that it was created from nothing by God.
Right.
So the same thing by the soul. The soul was created from nothing. God created the soul from nothing. We say it in the Siddur every morning, that the soul that you breathe into us, that you created it.
So then, in the same way that the earth and all the physicality around us was created from nothing, the soul was also created from nothing.
Yes, of course.
And just to clarify, then, when you're with someone who dies, right before they die, there's a living creature there. And once they die, there's a body there, but clearly the life force has left it.
Right.
And is that synonymous with what we're talking about here with the soul?
Yes, the soul is that which gives the body, you know, emotion. But the body itself is not the person.
I'm sorry, say that last again?
The body itself is not the person.
Right.
The soul is what gives the body emotion. But it doesn't give... You know, you wouldn't say the soul gives the body life, because the soul itself is the life, whether it's in the person or it's not in the person. So when you're speaking to a person, so you're speaking really to a soul. That's the living part of the person. He has the ability to articulate, to think, to speak, to comprehend. So that is always a soul. It's not, we make a mistake that it's in the body just because we have to relate to people on a physical basis. So we assume the soul is in the body. Really, the soul is not in the body. It's, like Reverend Chait once said, it's functionally related to the body. But since the soul is not physical, it can't take up any geographical space. It has no location.
So when a person dies, and again, I'm looking at that, you know, a few seconds before to a few seconds after.
Right.
Is the difference that the soul left or that something else also left?
No, just the soul.
Just the soul, okay.
Yeah, that's it.
So the soul is essentially what transforms, you know, a bunch of non-living cells into a living human being.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, I'm just trying to clarify that point.
Right. So now if we get back to the point here, and that is that it says don't create molten gods for yourself. So the difference is like Cal was saying, that all other idols are things which exist already, and the mistake that the person is making is this is how I relate to God. But at least the thing has existence. The thing is real. The sun is real. People who worship the sun, or the moon, or trees, or even a rock is a real entity. But when a person creates a molten god, now what he's doing is, like most idolatry you'll see is like, you know, it's half fish, half man. They conjure up imagination. So now it's even more removed from reality, because at least the people who are bowing down to the sun, so the sun is a real thing. Their mistake was to give the sun a certain amount of credibility. But the people who make up gods, the molten gods, or like you would say, they take some grass and stuff it into some cloth or whatever, they're making two mistakes. They're now assuming that something that's just a mere imagination is real. It's more of a subtle error. So you see the difference? One person at least takes something which is in existence and attributes credibility to it and says that it has certain powers. The person who's worse is not even dealing with reality. He's making up new things, and he molds something new. And that's why I think the beginning of the verse also talks about the fact that you shouldn't turn in your heart, like Ibn Ezra says. Al tifnu el halilim. Don't turn, even in your heart, to meaning your imagination. The Torah here is telling you a higher level of standard that God is requiring of a person who's keeping the 613 commands. And that is, it's true that you have the rest of the 612, and that includes not creating, not worshipping idolatry and so on. But now God is exacting a certain level, a certain increased level of perfection. So when it says in the beginning you should be kadosh, you should be sanctified, that means even in those areas that are mut, that are permitted to you, use those in a way which is intelligent. Just because I gave something to you and it's permitted doesn't mean that you should abuse it all day long. That's not the sense of why it's given to you. And in that same vein of being going a little bit above, meaning being careful with how you use that which is permitted, so also how you think. And your imagination has to be something which you work on. So it's a very important lesson over here, I believe, that it's saying in this verse, that control your imagination in these two areas. Don't even turn to those things, like you made a point before, Doug. This is the gods, right? Don't turn to the gods. Evidently, it's referring to those things which are already in existence, right? But then the next part of the verse says, and molten gods you shouldn't make for yourself. So these are not in existence yet. These are things that you're just going to conjure up, and you're going to deviate further. So it seems to be the concept of this verse is that in the area of imagination, God is outlining certain deviations that you have to be sensitive to. And this is part of sanctifying yourself.
Rabbi?
Yes.
When you said with love in your heart, could that also, when you create something, you kind of start to identify with it, and the more time you spend with it, the more you begin to love it. And I wonder if that has anything to do with that statement too.
You said love in your heart. Well, what are you referring to?
What you had said earlier about, do you remember the phrase? It was, don't turn with love in your heart or something to the idols.
No, I didn't say love in your heart. Don't turn to the idols. There's no word love over here. If I did, it's a mistake, but I don't recall saying love. That's not really an issue over here at all.
Okay.
So it is an interesting verse, and it's right at the beginning, too. I know we touched on this once before. We said that, you know, when the Jews left Egypt, so they God says in the beginning of Parshas Bishalach that he was not going to take them in the direction towards the Philistines, because perhaps the Jews will have remorse in their heart, and they'll see war, and they'll want to go back to Egypt. So he took them, he didn't take them that way. And he took them towards the Red Sea. So he asked the question, why would they go back to Egypt? I mean, you have a compass. So if you're not going north, because that's where the Philistines are, it doesn't mean you have to go back to south, to where Egypt is. You can go east, you can go west, you can go northeast, southwest. Why all of a sudden would the Jews go right back to Egypt when they saw war? I mean, they just got out of the place that they were slaves for hundreds of years. So what we had suggested is that this mindset of Egypt being an authority was so ingrained in their psyches that they, even though they left the proximity of Egypt, they did not leave the mental state of viewing Egypt as being an authority, and they still felt a certain obligation to serve them. Amazing. And I suggested that I believe that's why the next event is the drowning of the Egyptians, because it was impossible for the Jews to now transform themselves and accept God if they still had the Egyptian rulers, the Egyptian nation, tattooed on their, indelibly on their psyche, that these are our leaders. So you can't accept God if that's how you're still functioning. So God had to emancipate them from that thinking, and he killed the Egyptians. At that point, before they even got to Sinai, so God gave three laws at the place called Moreh. And the three laws that he gave them were the Sabbath, honoring parents, and setting up courts. And we said that this is very odd. What is he giving these three laws? at this interim period of the transformation before they get to Sinai. And what we explained is that it was precisely these three that they needed, because as they now were emancipated from Egypt, but now they had to take on God as their new authority. And the way that's done in the national level is, and also in terms of the process of growth for a human being, is that first a person recognizes parents and has to honor them and fear them. As the person develops, he then has to follow the laws of the courts. And ultimately, this is, both of these are targeting the whole objective of the Sabbath, to recognize God as the Creator. So these three were essential in terms of the transformation, that they should now start accepting God, and now that Egypt was removed from their sense of reality because he killed them. So we see here at the beginning of Kedoshim also, it says that a person should fear his father and his mother, and he should keep the Sabbath. Interesting how it's right there in the beginning of Kedoshim. I mean, the real objective. And that explains also why, you know, honoring the parents is on the first tablet of the two tablets. Because as the rabbis explained, the first tablet deals with laws between man and God, and the second tablet addresses laws between man and man. So if the first tablet is addressing laws between man and God, what is the law of honoring parents doing there? Honoring parents should be on the second tablet, which addresses laws between man and man. But now we see it works out perfectly, that honoring your parents really is a means of approaching God and accepting God as authority. And that's the reason why God created people in a way where you're an infant and you grow, because it's necessary that from the very outset in life, this concept of an authority is stamped on our psyches. So we have to accept parents as being those who we fear, and we do psychologically. Eventually a person hits their teens and 20s, so now they realize that parents are no more superhuman than they are. It's the whole image that they had of their parents being, you know, superhuman or whatever it was that they had is now, you know, it dissolves. It's at that point precisely that a person either accepts that all people are the same, they're just mortal, and they accept that, and they recognize, they recognize God alone, or they go into idolatry. Okay.
Really?
Yes.
So, in verse 4, obviously, do not turn to idols, and there are a lot of things around and a lot of insidious forms that idolatry takes. So, I can see application of that, you know, even today. The second part, you know, don't make gods for yourselves, seems so far from you know, our everyday life. I mean, I don't have a smelting, you know, operation or even one available. Yet, so there's a tendency to say, well, gee, that doesn't really apply because, you know, a person in today's age would never get into that. But then my sense is that, gee, as soon as you start thinking that, there's probably a meaning that you're missing. What lesson can we take, or is there one, with regard to sort of practical application of that second half to us today?
Practical application of the second half of what?
Well, verse 4, about molten gods. Yeah, not making them.
Let's see. Not making them. How would it apply today? I mean,
I don't know of anybody who would even have the apparatus to do that.
Well, they do make statues of Jesus. I mean, Buddhas, they have that skill going on today. That hasn't changed.
Well, that's true. And maybe there isn't beyond that. Just being aware of do not have one that somebody else made. I mean, there are, you know, statuary stores and that sort of thing where you can go buy this stuff.
Right, certainly.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. For a while, and I think it still actually exists, we had an angel shop in our town.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Kind of surprised me that such a thing was even around. In fact, there was a front page article in the Wall Street Journal somewhere in the last about 7 years, right in the middle of the front page, that was all about that the making of angels and those kinds of things was a really, really good business.
Huh. Yeah, people have a real need. And they can't emancipate themselves because they see everybody else doing it. That's a tough thing. It's a tough thing to go against the crowd, to go against the tide where everybody else, and to really be independent and stand on your own based on just what reason tells you.
Yeah.
It's a big, big loss. But, yeah, you see that that's a real important thing here right in the beginning. Talks about the same two laws, Sabbath and honoring the parents. Yeah. Yeah, that's really the opposite of what. That's why it comes right after honoring the parents and Shabbos, because the antithesis of what Shabbos and the parents is targeting is idolatry. So you see, it's telling you that you have to be very careful with. See, it's not talking about the blatant law. Initially, it's telling you it starts off by saying honoring parents and keep the Sabbath, because those are really going to lead you. I mean, if you're very careful with that, then it will lead you to the proper life. You could have started out by just saying, accept me, I'm God, and don't make idols. No, that's the Ten Commandments. That's something else. Ten Commandments is giving you the core, clear principles, fundamentals. The head categories, as Sadi Gaon says. But Kedoshim is talking about the subtleties, the nuances, meaning, you see what I'm saying? It's telling you that by honoring the parents and keeping the Sabbath and not inclining us and not even entertaining the other gods, of course, not to make them, but it's giving priority in this parsha, in this section of the Torah, to those, I don't know if you want to call them ancillary, but those very laws that will cultivate the right type of Torah personality. Because again, you see that the law is telling you, Kedoshim is telling you, the very fact that God has to tell his people, sanctify yourself, is clearly telling you that even though I gave you so many laws already, it's possible you can deviate. It's possible that you will just look at the laws per se, and you will not be focusing in on a certain underlying message or a higher goal. It's not just doing these actions. That could be an error that a person makes. He feels that, let me just do all the laws, that's it, that's all, you know, God wants. But that's not changing the personality. In order for the personality to be changed, I think the rabbis even say you can't teach somebody who has a bad personality. It's not going to register. There has to be the goal that the person is now changing his inner world, his psyche, his sense of values. And that takes time. So it has to start right from youth. So he has to honor his parents right away. This will cultivate the right personality. Here, let's take a look. There's one more. Let's see what it says here in the verse A. In the fifth verse, it says, zoom. Yeah, look, it says the next verse. Verse hey. That the fifth verse, that when you sacrifice to God a peace offering, it should be l'tzon lechem, to your it should be the right will, the proper intent. So Rashi says this only comes to teach you that you should eat the sacrifice in the right time frame. Interesting. It's not telling you that you should sacrifice. It's telling you again a nuance that when you do the sacrifice, there should be the right concept as to what you're doing. It's not just a matter of bringing an animal to God. There are certain laws, and there's confines. There's a limit to how to when you can eat the sacrifice. And Rashi says further that if you don't have the right intent in your mind, it will not be something which God desires at all. So you see again, Rashi is targeting the underlying personality over here. It's a very important parsha kedushim. Don't think it's the action per se. The Torah is not about the actions. A person can do all the actions and still violate the underlying perfection that he's really supposed to be achieving. So Ibn Ezra and Rashi are all pointing to that. Is all it is. That's all
just
it is.
Just going through motions.
Right. Now, if you go through the parsha more, maybe we'll take this more up next week too. You'll see that it continues. Different nuances. How a person has to be delicate. If you want, take a look at the next couple of verses, and see if you could target how the theme continues. Right, it talks about when you harvest your field, don't harvest the corners, and anything that you drop. There are laws about leaving things for the poor people. Interesting stuff. Interesting. It's a whole different angle of Torah, and it's necessary. It's a real necessary thing.
So, if you keep a mitzvah technically, but your internal attitude is, "I'm doing this because I have to, not because I really want to," then am I getting that you have fulfilled it, or you haven't really? Or is it a little bit of both?
I think there's a division of mitzvahs. Actually, Rabbi Pinny Rosenthal was telling me this last week, that there are some mitzvahs where the mitzvah itself is just the action, and no real intent or thought really plays a role in terms of the fulfilling the action. It could be, though, that a person has no idea what he's doing. Like Rabbi Chaitin mentioned, he quoted Rashi, that if a person does the command, he doesn't know why he's doing it, so what use is it? Which makes sense. But there are certain mitzvahs that require more intent, like, for example, prayer. So now the whole concept of prayer is a conscious type of activity of dialogue, as opposed to waving the lulav. Putting on tefillin is a different type. So I probably want to discuss it with him more. He was talking about, I think a good idea. Maybe I'll ask him if he could write something up so he could share it with us. But if you think about it, that there are certain mitzvahs that require much more of intent and, contemplation. Certainly, by bringing the sacrifice, Rashi says openly, you have to have the right intent in your mind when you bring it. If you think that I'm going to eat this animal after the time zone, so that ruins the entire sacrifice. The thought that you have in bringing the sacrifice is amazing. It could nullify the whole, you did not fulfill your obligation. You did the same physical act of sacrifice as anybody else, but since your thought was off, it ruins it, which shows you that sacrifice is a much higher caliber activity.
So that raises an interesting question about how that applies to a ben Noach, because the only positive commandment that we have is to establish courts of law, and we've discussed that that is, in a practical way, impossible today. And so you're left with six negative commands or prohibitions, which we know devolve into more specifics, but they really boil down to negatives. And so for Ben Noach, I'm just thinking out loud here, what impact that idea of sort of attitude and intent has?
Well, again, we said, like Rabbi Shea explained, the Noahide laws are not a system of perfection. They are a minimal system that gives you, entitles a person a right to life. But really, the person shouldn't stop there.
Right.
I mean, all those areas of perfection, you know, certainly you should take on. This is just the minimal system that has to be if the, you know, society is going to be entitled to live. But, you know, Noahide, just like the Jew, is wise to keep all the commands. Certainly to keep all those areas of the deal of perfection, you know, prayer, charity, modesty, you know, what it talks about here in Kedoshim, not being hedonistical in sexual areas, and the appetitive drive, you know, loving your neighbor like yourself, all these different areas are, you know, the same perfection that a person who's born Jewish is available to a person who's not. A person born Jewish is the only difference. He has obligations. The design and the potential is exactly the same for any human being.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
All right, so let's wrap up here. Let's continue next week in this. Look forward in the verses. All right, so we're familiar with them. And let's go on and see if there's more we can pull out of here in terms of this type of an approach where it's not just telling you to do the commands, but it's giving us insight into certain nuances and how the Torah targets to cultivate a certain personality, not just to get the person to do technical activities.
Okay.
All right, so we'll pick up next week on this.
Sounds like it. Good thing to look forward to.
Okay, good. All right, so you and Kel have a very good week. And I'll look this up. We'll have something more to go further with. This is an interesting area.
Okay, very good. We appreciate it.
Okay, my pleasure. Have yourself a great week.
Thanks, Rabbi. You too.
Thanks,
Rabbi.
Thanks.
You will.